Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Trust in politics is broken, so can we get UK politics working again?
That was the last time we were happy. 2012.
I'm Beth Rigby, Sky's political editor. Join me every week with Labour's Jess Phillips and Conservative peer Ruth Davidson for some electoral dysfunction.
This idea of nuance has completely left politics. Yeah.
Together we'll focus on the policies that could deliver political satisfaction. Follow Electoral Dysfunction wherever you get your podcasts.
The New Statesman.
This episode was recorded on Thursday, the 18th of April, before news broke of Israel's missile strike on Iran.
Tensions in the Middle East have heightened further after Iran launched a missile attack on Israel last week. This was in response to Israel's strike on the Iranian consulate in Damascus, Syria, which killed 16 people. Western leaders came to Israel's defence and condemned Iran's attack. But prior to this, David Cameron, the UK Foreign Secretary, had warned that the UK's support for Israel was not unconditional. So how have these latest developments divided the government's stance on Israel's conflict? And how are Labour planning to act should they come into government amid this war? Hello, I'm Anoush Shekelian, Britain editor of The New Statesman and host of this podcast. And joining me in the studio, I have our senior editor, George Eaton, and political correspondent, Freddie Hayward. So last weekend, on Saturday night, Iran launched a missile attack on Israel. The US, UK, France and Jordan came to Israel's defence and intercepted the attack. This has drastically heightened international tensions relating to the region's conflict. But well before this latest development, the UK government has been struggling to present a united strategy. And George, you wrote last week on the new Tory divide on Israel. It's a great piece, and we'll put a link to it in the show notes if our listeners haven't read it yet. But could you give us an overview of this new divide that you've identified?
Yes. So I characterise it as a new divide between the Israel-files on the one hand and the Israel-sceptics on the other. And Israel fires I describe as those who see full-throated, shoulder-to-shoulder solidarity with Israel as a sort of test of your conservative credentials.
Mm-hmm.
It's people like Boris Johnson, Lord Frost, Suella Braverman, Liz Truss. Then on the other hand, you have the Israel skeptics. I'd put David Cameron in that camp, actually. People like Alicia Kearns, who's chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee. And these are MPs and peers who, for instance, have concerns over possible violations of international law, who are concerned by violence, settlers on the West Bank. Cameron imposed sanctions on them, and who were prepared to suspend UK arms sales to Israel. Now, what's interesting is that, setting this in a historical context, the Conservatives weren't always traditionally seen as a pro-Israel party. So Ted Heath, the Conservative PM, suspended arms sales during the Yom Kippur War in 1973. But since the Thatcher era, really, it has been a broadly pro-Israel party. But you're seeing this divide emerge because I think Israel has moved to the right and moved too far to the right for some conservatives. And so you see this divide, I think, is going to even play out at the next leadership election, when I think people will say, did you stand with Israel in its time of need, or were you sort of criticising from the sidelines?
It's interesting that David Cameron is one of the Israel sceptics that you've identified. Can you tell us a bit about, I mean, he is Foreign Secretary. Mm. How is it affecting or not affecting the government's approach to this conflict so far, because they have decided to carry on with selling arms to Israel?
What I think it means is that you've sometimes had inconsistency of message from Rishi Sunak and mm-hmm. David Cameron. So On Monday, when David Cameron was doing the broadcast rounds, he said Iran did have the right to respond to the bombing of its consulate in Damascus.
Mm-hmm.
Said, you know, any nation, the UK would regard that as unacceptable. He said the response was disproportionate. Rishi Sunak didn't repeat that, though. He didn't say that. So you are seeing this inconsistency. Cameron has been much tougher in his criticism of Israel. He was clearly more open to the idea of suspending arms sales. But I think the fact that Israel came under direct attack by Iran has quelled that divide for now, because the UK, as you say, was one of the countries that was involved in defending Israel. It doesn't make sense to then go on to suspend arms sales after that.
Yeah, and so is this sort of more of the Cameron spin versus substance, Freddie, which you've written about in sort of different contexts this week?
No, I do think he genuinely believes that. We've seen him talk on these lines for quite a few years. We've got to remember back when he was first became Tory leader, he described Gaza as a prison camp. He didn't repeat that very often in subsequent years, but that was already there. So we've seen that play out now. And I think this is partly because he's got this sort of free reign from number 10 to take on foreign policy. We have, as George said, seen this tension between David Cameron and Rishi Sunak. I remember pressing the PM spokesperson three or four times on Monday, going through all the things that David Cameron had said. For instance, he wrote in a Sunday Times piece this month that the UK support for Israel was not unconditional. Mm-hmm. Would the PM spokesperson agree with that? No, they wouldn't. And we went through them all.
Right.
And they wouldn't agree or say that the Prime Minister supported what the Foreign Secretary said. They just dodged the question. Now, I think that's interesting, as George said, because it's illustrative of this divide between the Foreign Office and number 10. But it has moved, I think George is right, it has moved onto different ground now. It's interesting, if you look into David Cameron's role in general, as you are right to suggest, Anoush, that he has beguiled some commentators by having a nice accent and being able to post on social media as if he's some prophetic diplomat. He did one Twitter video maybe 2 weeks ago at the NATO summit where he walked through a door and he spoke for 2 minutes nonstop. Which was enough for people to get very excited.
Without notes. Everyone in Westminster seems to find
famously,
so
as he does so well back in, you know, he's got his famous 2007 noteless speech. But I think that was interesting because he was setting himself up to go to the US and try and push this aid package through, which is giving aid both to Ukraine and to Israel. So he said he's going to meet, for instance, Mike Johnson, who's the Speaker of the House of Representatives and also a Trump ally. When he did go to the US, that meeting didn't materialise.
Yeah.
And I think many people view that as a snub. His call or his meeting with the US National Security Advisor was relegated to a call. He did meet Trump, but I don't think he was able to work his charms on the former president, who is essentially deciding what Republicans are doing in Congress at the moment. And he is very much opposed to the aid package. So his substance isn't really matching up to his image. And I think that's been a pattern now for maybe 3 or 4 months since he came into the role. Yes, he did add some solid marketing and he did calm things down. And I do think that as a former prime minister, he had a certain amount of gravitas on the international stage that his predecessors didn't. But has that materialized into a change in foreign policy? Well, it has a change in foreign policy, but has that foreign policy actually changed the actions of other countries? And no, I don't think it has.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, in terms of Cameron and Sunak's relationship, I think there's been some reporting that Sunak feels, you know, or there's a fear in number 10 that he's slightly being upstaged by the foreign secretary, that it was supposed to have been such a coup for him to have appointed. Do you think there's sort of anything in that, George?
Yes, but it's interesting. So I think Rishi Sunak obviously initially saw David Cameron's appointment as a bit of a coup for him. It gave him a chance to focus on the domestic front. Our columnist David Gawke recently reported that he's heard, you know, Sunak isn't very interested in foreign affairs.
No.
So maybe it made sense to outsource it to a former PM who's got an almost unrivaled contact book. But I think you're right that as well as the splits over foreign policy that everyone can see playing out in public, it does make a clear contrast with Rishi Sunak, you know, who hasn't won a general election, is an unelected PM, is not as experienced, is not as slick as Cameron. and who's leading a party which is at, you know, fallen to 19% in a poll out today, sort of 45-year low. Well, David Cameron, as an unelected peer, doesn't have to worry about such niceties as winning elections. So you can see why some in number 10 might feel it's not helping Sunak in that sense. But I think Freddie's completely right that for all of the admiration in Westminster, I think it was just that Cameron was doing stuff. You know, he was actually a cabinet minister showing some energy and vigour. Hasn't actually led to much of substance. How much of that is about sort of Britain's diminished role in the world? I think there's that. It probably doesn't help that global leaders can see the polls as we all can. They probably do see Keir Starmer and David Lammy as more important to the future of British foreign policy than David Cameron. And it's also, I think, some of the stunts that Cameron's pulled, you know, accusing Republicans of being Hitler-style appeasers by refusing to fund Ukraine. I'm not sure that that has done him much good in the long term in terms of actually changing policy as opposed to getting your one day news splash.
Yeah. I was speaking to someone in the sort of diplomatic world the other day, and they made an interesting point about the difference between Rishi Sunak and David Cameron. And they actually said that Sunak is a much more international figure. He spent much more time abroad. He is someone who understands Americans in a way that David Cameron perhaps doesn't. And then he also drew the comparison with David Lammy, who's much more similar as well. He's also spent time abroad.
Yeah.
So Cameron sort of falls between the two in many ways. He hasn't, you know, he's got this sort of like old style British Foreign Office approach to things. You know, you go in there and tell them what to do and crack heads together, and we'll see what we can do without fully understanding the country or the people that he's speaking to. It's an interesting comparison.
That's interesting. After the break, we'll discuss how Labour's position on the conflict might shift. If you're subscribed to The New Statesman, you can get all our episodes ad-free on the New Statesman app. You can get it on both iOS and Android. Just search for New Statesman on the App Store or Google Play Store. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Yeah, and I'm really glad that you brought us on to Starmer and Lammy, George, because it's interesting to see how Labour shifts its position in terms of what's going on in the international arena. I remember interviewing John Healey a few weeks ago, and he would not say that defence spending should increase to the 2.5% of GDP, which has been the Tory target for a while. That hasn't been met. And he wouldn't even say that he was pushing for it behind the scenes. In fact, he denied that he had ever asked Rachel Reeves for to be allowed to
commit that. The cardinal sin of asking for more money.
Exactly.
Rachel Reeves.
He was like, no, we would get into government, we would see what the threats were and see what the money situation was and then sort of decide what our defence spending should be. That's shifted slightly. Keir Starmer has committed more recently to that target as soon as resources allow or as soon as circumstances allow, which I think is the same as their DFID spending promise as well, the 0.7%.
Yeah, they may as well say they'll build a bridge to Northern Ireland.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It doesn't necessarily mean that there's a substantial change in the position. But you can see Labour's approach sort of morphing as the conflict gets more and more intense. Freddie, what's your take on sort of how they're positioning themselves now?
Well, having ridiculed that 2.5% commitment, it is a signal. Essentially, that's what it is. They're saying, look, we take defence very seriously. We recognise the long-term trend throughout Europe and America that defence spending needs to increase. So I think that's where it comes from. There are some in Labour who've been pushing for it, and they welcomed it. Essentially, I also think it'll help Keir Starmer and David Lammy navigate a Trump and Republican presidency, because it's a statement that they will burden share and they will stump up the money that's needed for defence in the face of a threat from Russia. We also had this very interesting essay from David Lammy in Foreign Affairs this week, which I wrote about in Morning Call, which of course you can subscribe to in the notes below.
Yeah,
I think it was the most extensive outline we've had of what he calls progressive realism, which is his overarching mantra or you know idea for his foreign policy. He sees it as combining the sort of gritty practicality of Ernest Bevin, who you know the Clement Attlee's foreign secretary, who is integral to setting up NATO and also developing the UK's nuclear deterrent, with Robin Cook's, Tony Blair's foreign secretary, ethical foreign policy, which prioritised human rights, climate change, promoting democracy, these sort of things. So he sees a combination of the two as the appropriate way in which we should view the world at the moment. This is not new. We saw it in a Fabian speech last year, but it was a 4,000-word essay that I think tried to communicate both to the you know the diplomatic and foreign affairs establishment and to others who you know read foreign affairs every month, that this is where he wants to go. So it's an approach that takes the global south very seriously and recognises that many there in Africa and also in South Asia have looked at the UK's response to the vaccine rollout to Israel and have been angry about that or dissatisfied and are looking therefore to China and Russia. So they want to rectify that. They also want to change the tone of international relations. There's many things in which they want to take a practical approach to achieve progressive ends, as they say. Now, overarching or underlining all of this is, I think, as we mentioned earlier, a sense that the UK is a diminished power within the world. And I think when David Lammy talks about realism, it's not so much in the international relations theory sense of the word. It's much more about let's be realistic about what we can actually do.
And I have spoken to people within the Foreign Office about this. And I think there is a little bit of scepticism at how different this platform is to what the current government is doing. I think there's a bit of scepticism, for example, about this idea, I mean, on the defence side, that they will, you know, strike this defence pact with the EU and with Germany, because they, you know, the sense within the department is that there is already a sort of de facto kind of agreement with the EU and Germany already on the UK side. So how different could a Labour government's foreign policy or defence stance be, George, do you think?
So I think one area is greater consistency. I mean, that sounds obvious, but it does help with foreign policy. I mean, Lammy and his team point out, you know, the government's had a huge number of different stances on China.
Yeah.
You know, the golden era under Cameron and Osborne, then Theresa May being far more hawkish, mistrust more hawkish too. Sunak's position on China, I don't think is particularly clear. Obviously, you've had many different phases of Brexit and Europe. So and some of that has been change of prime ministers and also sometimes very weak governments. So I think if you have a Labour government with a large majority, that will allow for much more consistency. You'd imagine that Keir Starmer would want, you know, David Lammy potentially to serve a full term as Foreign Secretary rather than this pivotal job just being one that's reshuffled at various points. I think the Defence and Security Pact, Labour see it as something bigger than simply traditional security in the traditional military sense, but as encompassing agreements on climate, migration, critical materials. And some of this is about, Lammy Smith have said, sort of unlocking securenomics on a global stage. So securenomics is Rachel Reeves's phrase for her economic doctrine, the idea that you need a more active state in an era of greater threats and risks. And of course, the foreign secretary is integral to that. You know, Lammy uses the example of a sort of electric vehicle. You know, where does the cobalt come from? Where does the lithium come from? The foreign secretary has a key part to play in relations with the countries you need to develop industry.
Brilliant. Okay, well, thank you so much, both of you, and thanks so much for listening. If you'd like to submit a question for us to discuss on a future podcast, you can do so at newstatesman.com/youaskus. And if you're listening on Spotify, you can just scroll down on the episode page and type your reply in. Or if you're watching on YouTube, you can leave a question in the comments. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Anoush Shakelian, and my colleagues George Eaton and Freddie Haywood. We'll be back on Monday to discuss the influence and impact of boarding schools on Britain. This episode was produced by Catherine Hughes.
Hold up.
Trust in politics is broken. So can we get UK politics working again?
That was the last time we were happy. 2012.
I'm Beth Rigby, Sky's political editor. Join me every week with Labour's Jess Phillips and Conservative peer Ruth Davidson for some electoral dysfunction.
This idea of nuance has completely left politics. Yeah.
Together, we'll focus on the policies that could deliver political satisfaction. Follow Electoral Dysfunction wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.